Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions, world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Back when movies were relatively young and the major studios were establishing themselves, each of them carved out a genre or a style that represented it, unlike these days when the studios really don't have individual identities. Warner Brothers made gritty, timely, violent crime dramas with the likes of James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart. MGM made big-budget, big-star, glossy musicals with color and grandeur from their vast carousel of huge stars. And then, of course, there was Carl Laemmle's Universal Pictures. Though now their studio is geographically the biggest in the world, if not in terms of box office these days, they were scrappier, more willing to dip their toes into the blood and muck, and became famous for their classic monsters. What a wonderful run they had, starting in the mid-20s with The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. But the 1930s really opened the goldmine of famous monsters. Dracula and Frankenstein both came out in 1931, The Mummy in 1932, The Invisible Man in 1933, Werewolf of London in 1935. Then came The Wolfman in 1941, The Creature from the Black Lagoon in 1954, and Norman Bates in Psycho in 1960. They became the monster studio, and it provided them with huge success for decades. They paired up the monsters in sequels and milked the life's blood out of them until finally, after having the monsters, starting with Frankenstein's, meet Abbott and Costello, it was hard for audiences of the day to take these creatures of the night seriously anymore. But for a couple of decades or more, Universal has tried and tried to raise their classic creatures from the dead, mostly without success. There have been reboots from a couple versions of The Mummy, a couple unmade versions that I worked on, one with Clive Barker, to The Wolfman, to The Invisible Man, to Renfield, with projects that have been in development that never reached the screen yet, like The Bride of Frankenstein, which Bill Condon was developing for years, and now I hear is just been announced with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Christian Bale as we're recording this. The two characters who've most been adapted to the screen from written material are Sherlock Holmes and Count Dracula. However, no one has ever gone back to the captain's log contained within Bram Stoker's original novel that takes place on the Demeter, the ship that brought that dreadful vampire to London from Transylvania. Until now. We're going to talk with the talented director of The Last Voyage of the Demeter, Andre Overdahl, about what it's like to bring new blood to an old monster. Andre, it's good to have you back. You were here last time for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, but we learned a lot about your beginnings in Norway. So tell me, what was your first introduction to these classic monsters that you're now on the team?
I'm very happy to be back. Thank you for inviting me again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I mean, I've loved monster movies my whole life. I've loved that, you know, all through the ages. But I gotta say, I probably discovered them in my own time in the 70s and 80s, especially in the 80s, I guess. And there were monsters, I guess, were more human, I guess, at that time, more slasher oriented, more
less than, supernatural, huh?
Yeah, less out and out monsters the way we probably think of them today. But I've, you know, of course, I've gone back and seen all these movies, but I gotta say, The Thing obviously is the one, probably an Alien, and these classic movies that have become, you know, have become classics, are the ones that gets, you know, are stick with you.
Was it hard to be a monster fan in a town in Norway when you were growing up?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I didn't really live near a theater, so I was more a child of VHS. I was more finding, I lived in video stores my whole upbringing. Every day after school, I would run into the video store and pick up, stand there for hours and read on the back of movie after movie, and especially in the horror section. For some reason, I was always very attracted to that. So I watched, rented everything I could get a hold of, and remember having my parents get me movies that weren't available in Norway from London when they went there for vacation or something.
Well, what is the situation? How do you become a filmmaker in Norway? Is there a big film industry, a Scandinavian film industry that's centered in Norway?
Yeah, I mean, every Scandinavian country has their own governmentally supported film industry. And there are grants. There are, you know, you kind of have to have some relationship to the Norwegian Film Institute to be able to get a movie off the ground somehow. And that was also true for my first movie, Trollhunter, that was half financed by the Norwegian government.
And here it was, a monster movie. How difficult is it to convince a governmental entity to support a monster movie?
I mean, I have to credit the producer, John Jacobson, because it was entirely based on his support for the movie. He loved the concept. He loved the idea. And he literally just went into the Film Institute and made, you know, obviously made all the official applications and everything. But he convinced them, based on his weight as a producer, that this was something we have to make. This is going to be an amazing movie. This is going to be something you've never seen before. And somehow they bit. They, you know, they joined us on that journey.
And he was right. It became something really special that was a hit at the festivals, was released in theaters all around the world. And suddenly you are a master of horror in certain ways. And tell me what the reaction to that was from different things. Were you offered a bunch of independent horror movies, studio movies, anything along those lines? What was the reaction career-wise for you?
I mean, it was kind of, we went to Texas to Fantastic Fest to show it as a secret screening the first time. And I was terrified. I mean, I was terrified of showing the movie whatsoever, but especially with an audience that isn't Norwegian, that won't understand the jokes and all the inside stuff that the movie is filled with. And it was just, and in the middle of the night, we were watching it with an audience and they just loved it. And it was so amazing. It was just, it was just one of those experiences that, you know, light your life on fire.
And, well, it seemed like it was obvious that it would appeal to a Norwegian audience, but was it a shock the way that it went over with other international audiences?
It was. I mean, my ambition was that it would. I love Hollywood movies. I love the way Hollywood tells stories, but I have my own point of view into things. I'm looking at the world from a Scandinavian point of view, and that balance was what I was trying to strike. But I knew that I've developed and I've the entire thing is built on very, very detailed Norwegian mythology, and I wasn't expecting anybody to get any of the jokes, and they did, and it was and somehow the movie just worked. I remember telling the distribution company just days before and the producer just days before that it was, we were showing it to anybody that we can't show this movie publicly. This movie is a piece of garbage. We cannot possibly show it.
Oh, that's a good way to go out.
You know, but they obviously were going to do that anyway.
Yeah. You're not your best salesman, are you?
No, but no. So that was, and then, an agent from WME, Jerome Dubois, he contacted me on Facebook, of all things. And I remember his introduction was, "Hey, I'm an agent from WME, and we represent people like Ridley Scott and Quentin Tarantino and da 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 da." And I was like, "Yeah, I know who you are. I know who WME is. Thank you." So he came to Fantastic Fest and saw it there with me, and suddenly I have an agent. You know,
wow.
It was just a ride. The next few days was just extraordinary. And then Magnolia bought it for the US, and they did a fantastic, you know, thing out of it. And
so were you doing immediately a bunch of meetings with studios and producers and the like, and being sent scripts, and what kind of things were you being offered or at least solicited about?
I mean, tons of stuff. I mean, from micro-budget movies that have been made, movies that haven't been made, to bigger stuff that I was in dialogue about, but not really probably in real competition for at that moment. But the one thing I did do, though, was Chris Columbus, he fell in love with Trollhunter, and he optioned, together with CG Entertainment, the Korean company, he optioned the rights for a remake. But at the same time as he did that, he also had a script called Carpe Demon that I fell in love with. That was just so much fun. It was written by him and the Hagemans, who I worked with on Scary Stories. And it was just this blast of a movie. And I was developing that with him and his company, 1492, for a long time. And it's still one of my big regrets that that movie never got made. Making movies.
What were some of them that did get made, if you can tell us, that you were up for, that you were in contention for?
I mean, I don't know. I feel like it's, I don't know if I dare talk about those because they're not, okay. I don't know. I do. Yeah. Most of them aren't important movies in the grand scheme of things. So right. I'm in a way, some of them, I dodged a bullet, I think.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah. Well, I remember after writing Hocus Pocus for Disney, they sent me the script for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And I saw that and I just thought, this is way too big for me to do as my first movie with kids and special effects and all that. But that was a big budget movie that became a big hit. And my first movie had kids and special effects and all of that. And it was Critters 2 for no money. So it was, but it was one of those things I still feel like I wasn't prepared to do that at the time.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't know. I don't know how you choose and how that all comes together. It feels like sometimes like destiny, even though I don't really believe in that. It's, yeah, some things you're not ready for, even though you wish you were in hindsight, and some things you're glad you stayed away from.
Yeah. Now I'm going to Ramos Creek in October to the festival there. So I'm going to, is that not in the neighborhood where you shot Trollhunter?
Yes, it is. It definitely is. It's right around the corner in a way, speaking from at least comparatively from where you are now.
That's for sure.
So yeah, no, you'll see a lot of those environments. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. I mean, there is an interesting Scandinavian point of view in filmmaking, whether it's in the horror genre or in the crime noir sort of things, because of the long winter nights and the short summer day, you know, all of that darkness. There is also a sentient darkness about the characterizations and storylines that take place. Do you feel that that's endemic to the Scandinavians?
I mean, yeah, maybe. It feels like we're, I don't know. God, the winters here are dark and they're practically sinister. They do play with your mind. You're just begging for light at the end of the winter. And so if I have any excuse to go to LA in a midwinter, I'll jump on it.
And where are you based now, in London?
No, I'm in Oslo. I'm in Norway.
You're still there.
I live just outside the city. Yeah.
Great. Well, you have a very distinct version of Count Dracula as a full monster. It's not the gentleman who can sway the ladies and that sort of thing. So tell me about how that concept came about. Were you presented with a screenplay first?
Yeah, this script has been in development for a long time. Bragi Schjøtt wrote the script 20 years ago, and even more, I think almost 25. And it was announced in Variety in 2002, and it's been developed by many directors through the years with the producers that are still, I work with. And it just kind of, at the end of working on Scary Stories, I was working with Brad Fisher on The Long Walk, which we were attempting to get off the ground with New Line. And then this script came in through him, and also Guillermo del Toro provided some insight into it. I was part of pushing for me to take that movie. And that was just an amazing thing. So that just became kind of a competing project with The Long Walk. But I kept working on The Long Walk, and then until March 12th, 2020, when I literally was sitting in my living room with two big suitcases packed, ready to fly out to LA, to fly north in California to start prepping The Long Walk. We were in mid-casting, mid-everything.
Oh, my God.
And then Trump comes on TV and says, we're closing the borders. And I called New Line and I said, I can't go because I can't get stuck in America for, I have no idea what this pandemic is going to become, and not be able to go back home to my family. So we have to cancel it. And that's kind of what happened. And then we sit there and we start working on various things, and I'm developing various things. And I'm also part of, for the next 6 months, I'm part of a big TV series at Netflix called The Magic Order, which I took over from James Wan, who was supposed to direct the pilot there. And I ended up supposedly directing that pilot instead. And then they closed us down because Netflix was doing some changes to their, the way they were working, and they canceled the show while we were in prep in Prague.
Ouch.
Yeah. And then the silver lining there was I called Brad Fisher and I said, well, if we want to go, we can go now. We can just start prepping on Demeter. And we talked to, it was kind of a conversation with New Line and about The Long Walk. And they ended up, we just further ahead with Demeter. It just was suddenly more likely that it would go. And we ended up doing that. But that's, besides Carpe Demon, and I'm not involved with The Long Walk anymore, but unfortunately, that's really like one of my big regrets.
Let's talk more about that, because I know when we talked last time, a couple of years ago, The Long Walk was your next thing. And as someone who's done a lot of Stephen King work, people are constantly coming to me and saying, I love The Long Walk. Can you get it to get me to Stephen King to get the rights for that? And it's like, no, you do your own work. There's business to do. But people love that story, and people have tried to make it for years, and you are on the verge of making it. How heartbreaking was that?
Completely. I mean, absolutely. So the pandemic killed that one for me. I think it hasn't killed the movie, but it's put me out of it. So that was very sad. I was so invested in it, and I'd shortlisted the whole movie with the DOP.
Oh,
we sat
God.
For we sat for a month and a half with little Playmobil figures, with finding all the camera angles, taking pictures of every camera angle of how to shoot the movie visually.
Yeah, because it's such a difficult story to shoot. I mean, it's a simple story because it's just a bunch of people walking on the road forever.
Yeah.
And how do you keep that cinematically interesting is the challenge of the movie. So it sounds like you were really in the thick of that.
Oh, absolutely. I spent so much time on that movie. And I had a really good vision or take or whatever you call it for it, where I could completely see the movie. And we had some wonderful young actors that were dying to do it. And it's one of those, that's so far is the, in many ways, the biggest loss of my career is not to make that movie.
Uh-huh.
Also having been, also, as you know, extremely well, to have been part of, having had the opportunity to be part of the Stephen King legacy would have been just something for me as a person, as a film lover and story lover and Stephen King fan, you know, a huge thing.
Well, I feel so fortunate to have been involved in so many King projects, you know, being such a, not just a genre fan, but specifically a King fan, and to have been able to adapt some of my favorite things. And I know that this was one of your favorite King stories.
Yeah, no, it's such an amazing novel. And yeah, it's just one of those things, but we've got to move on from that.
Yeah. So, let's go on to Voyage of the Demeter and the actual take of Count Dracula, not as a count, but just as a monster. And the concept of that, because the movie's opening shortly, this will drop right before it opens. But I'd just love to get, without any real spoilers, how that concept was approached.
The concept of how he exists.
How you decided to do this one stage of Count Dracula, who is a creature who can take many forms.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just felt like I wanted to portray Dracula as a really old man. Like, he's hundreds of years old. I mean, my God, what hasn't he experienced? He's been a mass murderer for hundreds of years.
Yes.
I wanted to feel that and see that on him. I wanted to feel his life and as a texture on his face and the way he behaves. And of course, there aren't many people who can portray that kind of character on screen when you only have basically very limited storytelling. He's not a suave, charming, sophisticated aristocrat in this movie, though we have to hint to it. We have to hint to the fact that that is his total character. But in this movie, he's a feral human being who is desperate for blood, and he loses his blood supply that he's planned for this trip, and he needs to start killing the crew to survive. And he's on his last legs when he finally is able to start that process. And I wanted him to be frail. I wanted him to be emaciated and be at the bottom of his entire life in this particular moment. And eventually he rejuvenates, and he then starts to kill off the crew, like in the novel, like he's supposed to, in a way, like history tells us he did.
In the original 1931, basically you see the ship leave, you see the ship arrive, and you see Renfield doing his when it docks. But this, the entire movie is about the voyage, and it's set there. How did it change? You said it was in development for over 20 years. What changes did you bring to the form of the story and the character?
It's weird. The script, I've read a couple of drafts, but not many. I read two or three, I think. And the original draft that the first draft I read was basically one of Bragi's original drafts, Bragi Schjøtt, who came up with this. And and it's still the same story. It's the same crew, you know, getting on board, the same basic story outline, and fighting Dracula till, you know, the ship crashes in Whitby, like we know it does. And that was and then we tweaked some things. We tweaked Clemens's character. We tweaked Anna's character. They were different in previous drafts. We tweaked Toby, the kid's character, and mostly that kind of stuff. And some set pieces we worked on. Zach Olkiewicz did an amazing job. That's the guy, the writer I work with through, in a way, through the pandemic. So that was, yeah.
Well, just technically, the film is a massive achievement. I mean, there's a combination, first of all, shooting on water, shooting ships, shooting water. Now, I know a lot of it's digital, but a lot of it was practical. Tell me how you bounced between and made the decisions of how to do what. And how complicated was it on the stage when you were replicating being at sea?
Yeah, it's we decided to shoot in Berlin. So we worked in Babelsberg Studios, and we decided then at a certain point in prep that it would be beneficial to move all the exteriors to Malta, where we could then go into this huge tank they have there and shoot and build the entire ship.
Where they did Popeye years ago with Robert Altman. They built that tank.
Yeah, a little the village, yeah, there. And we we ended up moving all the exterior ship stuff there. So we started in with everything in inside the ship. We did in Berlin with a for like I think we shot for like 4 or 5 weeks, and which was fun and grueling to a degree, because it was just, weirdly enough, the set of the ship, which was built as one big piece, was so hard to film in, especially in the cargo hold. It was just like every day was like walking on, I don't know, was creating a whole new scenario of shooting a new shooting environment every day, even though we went back to the same place again.
Well, you're
again.
Constantly having to cut holes to be able to shoot parts of the set, the reverses and things that are complicated to have all in one, right?
Yeah, yeah. And just the set itself was so realistically constructed to be at the bottom of a, you know, a ship. And it was really amazingly built with real timber, real wood, heavy stuff.
And did you have it on a gimbal so that it could rock?
Parts of it. Yeah, we had some. We couldn't afford or couldn't do the whole big rig on that in the studio because it was just enormous on our budget. But we could. So we chose some pieces that we put outside to be able to gimbal that needed, that had scenes that needed it more. But we had. We did do some rocking to certain parts where we had it on. Also, we had lights that were moving up and down, like outside, so we could control them and give you the feeling, so you could feel the lights. And then we had, you know, all the lamps and loose things were on wires, literally just people standing with wires, pulling them to make sure that they moved at the same pace. It was kind of a very, you know, it was like, yeah, very practical. Old school. Well,
this is your by far the biggest scale you've worked on, and it had to be quite demanding and challenging as another part of your cinematic education as you continue your career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was lucky to be able to make a horror movie at this level, where, you know, there is a big studio movie, and it's a period piece, and it's a journey across the seas of Europe, and it's Dracula. It's a big legacy to keep in mind, and the way we depict it, and it has great actors and great characters, and it's a chamber piece in a way. It's a close quarters kind of horror movie, contained space kind of horror movie, but it's also vast in its presence, or the world we're actually in, because we're out in the ocean. So it had all these visual elements. So when we, so you create, you try to create claustrophobia inside, you know, the walls closing in, there is nowhere to escape. It's all these kind of feelings. And then when we go to Malta to shoot all the exteriors, you still have to retain that, weirdly enough, that feeling of limitations, limits to where you are. but still also at the same time feel the endlessness of your surroundings.
Shooting on water, you had actual practical full-size ships there? Were they partial ship? Or?
We had 1.5 ships. So we had one ship that was fully our set, which we could walk from one end to the other, and we could play out any scenario we wanted. And we had this idea in mind that we were going to be able to turn the ship around during the day for lighting purposes, because the light is obviously, we did continuity of where the sun is when we're shooting in daytime is huge. And it's very hard to do in such a massive set that actually becomes. But it turned out that was impossible, because you have so much rigging around the ship and the ship itself, just to get out onto it and da da da. And the ship itself, so it was like a 24-hour thing to... It was like a 24-hour thing to do it. So we were stuck with our position that way and that way. And, you know, you are in a tank, so you do have a view to the ocean. But in the end, you also have a larger view to containers and our crew and everything else the other way. So you end up having to shoot stuff you don't really want to see. So that's, you start putting up blue screens and having to rely on rotoscoping to get rid of stuff. Because you have suddenly 6 actors in a scene and you can't shoot that all in one angle, especially when the sun is at the same time is moving around like crazy during the day.
The light changing every time you do a setup on one of the other actors.
Yeah, it drives everybody insane. So you have to start shooting stuff with backgrounds you don't really want. So you start shooting in lower angles and then you realize, well, you can't shoot the whole movie like, you know, from up there in nostrils to avoid stuff, you know.
Well, the good news was mostly it was shot at night, or most of the movie takes place at night.
Yeah, in the end, you know, we shot like a couple of weeks on deck in daytime. And then, we shot the big Varna scene, the harbor scene, which was not a harbor whatsoever. That's a really like full CG environment. Well, not full. When you come into the harbor there, you do see there is a building there. But it was extended CG. The whole, all the ships there are CG. Besides, we had a half ship copy of the back half of the ship, but we had to extend the front half digitally. So there is a lot of digital work in those kind of environmental worlds.
So the whole,
yeah.
What was the most challenging part of shooting on this film?
I mean, as you know, it's time. It's all about getting through the day and maintaining quality, giving the actors space to live and breathe the moments and make errors and do the next take in a different way, or, you know, and then at the same time, there is so much technicality for every single shot and every single take. You have numerous things that need, in the most wilder scenes, when there is a storm, for example, or something. The boat was on rockers, so it was sitting, you know, rocking. And at the same time, you have wave machines that need to work because you're seeing the ocean. You have water cannons splashing water onto the deck. You have special effects makeup, which requires an enormous whole crew to run in and help Javier between every take. And you have rain towers that you need to wait for. That takes a couple of minutes every time from you press start on the rain tower button. It takes a couple of minutes to get all the water up and over the whole ship and then cover the whole ship. And then you got to wait for it all to, you know, to cover everything in view in the camera angle. And then you realize that your camera angle isn't quite the right one for that because it isn't covering something. And then you got to move the camera a little bit. And everybody's standing there under tents and with, you know, umbrellas
and the water just pouring down.
Yeah, water is pouring down and there is some stunt rig and da da da. But the thing is, all these things have to work simultaneously.
Right.
So you're waiting for 6, 7, 8 elements. Okay, that's running, that's running, that's running. For what, to just to get one take off the ground. And then right. You got to stop because you got to communicate with everybody. When you've done the take, you got to talk to everybody.
And then you have to adjust everything, of these 7 or 8 or 9 elements, 1 or 2 of them working right, 7 or 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you end up having to, we need to change the angle of that water cannon because it was hitting Corey in the face, and he wasn't supposed to, you know.
Well, you're very lucky because you started out using extensive CG when you made Troll Hunter. So you understood the technical aspects of it, which is great. But movies are about storytelling and about characters in situations. So you have to balance that knowledge and expertise in the technical aspects, as well as the human and emotional ones. That must have been quite challenging for you on a movie of this scope.
Yeah, absolutely. It's truly the thing that in the end it all boils down to, is that whatever all this hoopla that is happening around you, you kind of have to ignore it. You have to be focused on what you have to be there with the actors and get the right moment and performance. And the most energy you actually spend, you have to rely on the crew, the first AD, DP, everybody around you to get all that stuff up and running so you can focus on what your main thing need is to communicate with the actors and, in a way, the camera, because that is the same in my world, in my head, that's the same thing. How you film an actor is as crucial as almost as what the actor is doing, because it depends on how you portray what he's doing, he or she.
Right. The lenses make a huge emotional difference in how you shoot a scene and how you choose to shoot a close-up or a medium shot or whatever. The lens is a very eloquent part of filmmaking and is the essence of it.
Yeah, it's truly the essence of, and I really believe that a performance captured by where the camera is and how it's actually filming the actor is as crucial as anything. So they have to trust that I know how to film their performance, and I have to trust that, you know, everyone else. So it becomes a circle of trust, as a movie should be. But so I'm there with the actors and trying to pay as little attention as that to that all the rest as possible. But of course, when something goes wrong or you need to change something, you have to deal with that. But you're right, that balance is the trickiest one.
Well, what was the first Dracula movie you remember seeing? Maybe Coppola's, or maybe, well, no, that's 92.
I've seen Dracula.
Probably, maybe the Bela Lugosi from 31 or Langella from 79.
I think actually the Langella one, because I've been so in love with John Williams' music my whole life. So he did obviously the music for that movie. And so I think I actually sought that out in my teens. And I would imagine that's my first one.
Yeah, John Badham did a beautiful job with that.
Yeah, and it's actually one movie where the ship journey is portrayed, has more time in the movie.
Well, tell me about conceptualizing the look of Dracula for this movie, because it's very specific. It harkens back a little bit to one of the forms he takes in Francis Coppola's Dracula, the Greg Canham design, but different. Tell me what you wanted it to represent.
I mean, I wanted it to be, we called him the man, the version that, the look he has for the beginning of the movie. And then we had one version that was more emaciated when, you know, the further out he gets, we called him the emaciated man. And then eventually you have the bat, you know, and I wanted to make sure that the bat was more than referencing other movies. Of course, I know the Dracula, or that depiction in Coppola's Dracula, but we briefly looked at it, but it wasn't really a part of the inspiration source. I worked with Mike Hill for a bit on designing.
And he's Dracula. A brilliant sculptor on his own, even outside of the world of makeup effects. And I know he's worked with Guillermo a lot, and his statues are phenomenal.
Yeah, he did an amazing maquette of what Dracula would look like. He couldn't be part of the rest of the journey. He was just part of my development process. And then we had Göran Lundström, who's actually Swedish, and he kind of worked out the whole with his team, worked out the further look and the further development with the actual head and with the body. And he is the one who actually created the creature design. the final version of it. And but that was, you know, of course, an amazing, again, amazing to see these super talented people come up with all these great ideas for how the wings and how membranes and how muscles and how what ear designs and eye and how should, you know, should the eyes look like this or like that. There's, you know, and in the end, we also wanted to have these kind of reflective eyes that has this animalistic quality to them. And make that feel natural as, you know, as a reflection more than as a, you know, as a demonic light. And Brad Fisher was hugely important in this whole process because he loves his horror movies. He's a huge fan of the genre, and he would stand there next to me and he would be communicating with everyone as much as I would at times on everything. And we're great friends and have, we had a true love for this stuff. And we, of course, both in awe of Guillermo's creatures and the way he and his team mates, like for example Mike Hill,
yeah,
and Javier, who portrays Dracula. So we
Well, the fact that this is based on a novel written in the 19th century puts it in the public domain, like Frankenstein is in the public domain. So any of the studios can and have done adaptations of Dracula and Frankenstein. TriStar did Frankenstein with Kenneth Branagh directing it. Coppola did it for Columbia. But how did it feel doing a Dracula movie for, did it make a difference that it was actually for Universal to you?
I mean, yes, in a way you're indirectly, but also it was for DreamWorks. You know, I was working with DreamWorks and Amblin mostly. Universal comes
my
in.
My first employers, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's so there, so that's where my main, they were the studio in the movie. Universal takes over the movie upon the release and becomes the studio then, or at least partner with Amblin on you know, marketing and how it all should plan out. But but having the Universal logo and knowing it's, in a way, it's going to be part of the Universal monster movie legacy, regardless of where it originates, is, of course, fantastic. I do see sometimes online that people are putting it in context with the general monster movie universe.
The quote, Universal classic monsters. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm happy to see that. Not that I can't really say that it's technically part of that, whatever that is at this stage. But I think it's wonderful to see that people are putting it, those things together.
Yeah. Do you think the studio appreciates what they have, or do you think it's seen more as a commodity that they try and, you know, they did two versions of The Mummy that were action adventure movies rather than horror films. Renfield is more comedy than anything else. I know that Bill Condon had a really wonderful script for Bride of Frankenstein that he was going to direct, but it never seemed to happen. Do you think there's an appreciation for the history of the classic monsters in the tower, in the Black Tower at Universal?
The Black Tower. I think so, yeah. I mean, I think I've had conversations with Universal through these last few years, even when the monster universe was in, you know, in the Tom Cruise world, you know, yes, when they were planning on those big movies. I had meetings on it even back then. I always felt like they really want to make right. They want to do something that has, they can be proud of themselves. These are just people sitting there with having been movie fans, and then suddenly they're an executive in a studio or whatever they are, and they love movies as much as we do. So I think they're also excited to be part of that legacy. Everybody knows about it. Sometimes things don't work out as you planned, you know, as that original bigger version clearly didn't work out, but that doesn't mean that it's anybody's fault in a way, that it becomes because of studio politics. I think everyone I meet and talk to are really engaged, and also, you know, also of course at DreamWorks and Amblin, they're they were hugely engaged in making this the best movie we could possibly make it.
Yeah. So aside from the John Badham Dracula, what have been your favorite screen performances of Dracula?
I mean, you know, of course, Max Schreck is wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just the way he moves and the way he stands and the way silent movies, obviously, it has its own things there. But
and that's Nosferatu in 1922. Yeah.
Sorry. Yes, of course. Yeah. And I think that's a depiction that still is maybe the, I don't know, in my world, the most iconic one.
And Toby Hooper borrowed heavily in his Barlow for the his Stephen King adaptation for television of Salem's Lot.
Yeah, of course. And that's, you know, if you would momentarily indulge in making that a Dracula, that's obviously a huge one as well. You know, Barlow is, it's a wonderful depiction. And no, I mean, Bela Lugosi and Louis Jordan.
That was a great version, the television version.
Yeah, it was actually. And of course, Gary Oldman. I mean, how can you not include him?
Yeah.
Totally iconic.
And are you a Chris Lee or a Bela Lugosi man?
I mean, I think Christopher Lee is great fun. I got to say, I would probably lean towards Christopher Lee, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is the enduring appeal of Dracula? I mean, starting in 1922 with Nosferatu, which was not a legally authorized version of the book Dracula, and so all of the prints were destroyed when it was released back in the 20s. But why do you think it endures? Why do you think the appeal of Dracula endures?
I don't know. I think it's such an amazing character. First of all, it's a villain. We all love great villains, and he's the greatest villain in our culture, I would say. And I think that alone is just a complex character who is sophisticated and who is at the same time just a brutal murderer. But also there is alluring aspects to him. There is a, you know, undercurrent of sexuality in what he is. And I think that always appeals, and that has been pushed into completely different versions of a vampire, from, you know, Twilight on one end to Renfield on another. and actually ours in a way on the other side of Twilight, which is just a brutal, simple version of it. And I think there's a timelessness about, he brings out the worst in people. He creates evil. He creates evil within others. He changes people. I think there is so many. He was exploring oppressed sexuality in a way in the Victorian times. And he was exploring so many things. I feel like that somehow you gravitate towards one or the other side of this.
Would you like to go back to the world of the Universal classic monsters again?
Oh yeah, I mean, there are so many wonderful stories to be told in that universe.
Who would you like to approach?
I don't know. I mean, Jekyll and Hyde is really fascinating. I mean, could you make another movie about the mummy? I don't know.
I wrote two different versions that were completely different. One of which Clive Barker was going to direct, and it was his story idea. And another one I took over for George Romero when he took on another project that fell apart. But it doesn't seem like there'd be that many ways to do the mummy, who basically shambles along, and it's like, oh, here comes the mummy. We better walk a little faster.
Yeah, no, I think, but I think they did such a clever version of Invisible Man. I mean, I thought that was really spooky and smart and fun. And yeah.
Yeah, Lee Wanhell did a great job with that. And it was a good success for the studio.
Yeah, yeah. And it proved you could make a small version of a movie like that. And if it's well enough written and directed and acted, it's there you go. You got a classic movie.
Well, the name The Demeter is not well known to the general public. So it's not obvious that this is a Dracula story. How do you pitch the audience on the movie that they're coming to see?
I mean, technically, I mean, obviously Universal is really concerned with that. I mean, they're working on that. They're pushing the name Dracula out there to make sure that the audience connects Dracula to the title. I do see that as a big problem, but I think it's I love the title. I mean, I could never change that title. That's literally what it is. I love long titles, I guess.
Yes.
It is the story of what I love about it is that we're seeing Dracula from a point of view we've never seen him before, from a crew of just random regular people, workers on their ship, this old cargo ship that is of no note in history of the world, and just this enormous presence, this demonic presence, just happens to pass through this ship on this journey to get to England, to get to London. And it's just this fight or this conflict between grounded, scientific in a way, and people, grounded people, real life people who are just up against this demon that they don't even understand. And I love that conflict in most of my movies. I think I'm dealing with the same thing over and over again because I'm fascinated by that. So I'm attracted to those kind of screenplays. And I think I do see that people also enjoy that kind of stories.
Yeah, well, I've seen it described as Alien on a ship.
Yeah, that's really where it's Alien on a ship in 1897. Just at this time, Dracula is the creature they're fighting.
Yeah, well, you work a lot with claustrophobia. I mean, The Autopsy of Jane Doe is such a great movie, and it's so small and contained, but it is so claustrophobic and filled with dread. Dread, I think, is a word that would describe a lot of your work in pursuing that. And how do you create a sense of dread?
That's a good question. I mean, it's just... there are technical things. There is the focus on the unseen and the anticipation. I love anticipation. I love the Hitchcock theories of how you create suspense. And then the dread is the fear of what is there that you cannot predict. And the more unpredictable you can make it within reason, the better it is, the more you can create a sense of foreboding dread. But it's also about sound. It's about camera angles. It's about pacing. It's about the performances of the actors. You know, this actually the details of the actors' performances, how little can they portray, actually, is usually where I would go. It's not how big they can react. It's how little can they react.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was doing the Shining miniseries, every time I do a show, I try and find a word that best encapsulates what we're trying for. And the word for the Shining miniseries was dread. And you can just do a wide angle shot from the floor of an empty room and have a low sound and create a sense of impending doom and dread. And you have so many different approaches to creating dread that it's just a fascinating cinematic concept to talk about.
Yeah, it's so funny to speak with you because I love that. I was so excited to see that novel filmed that way, like intended. And I love the series, The Shining.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah,
it helped that King wrote the script.
Well, Sure, that's a great bonus. Yeah.
What's next for you? Would you ever, would you consider going back to the Long Walk, or has that been assigned to another director at this point? Or what is next in the André Overdahl pipeline?
No, I mean, if somebody asks me to go back to Long Walk, I would. But beyond that, I do believe it might be spoken for. But but beyond that, I don't know. Of course, there is Scary Stories too. But all dialogue on all my projects have naturally stopped because of strikes.
Right, the strikes which are affecting everybody.
Yeah, yeah. So, and also, we had this beautiful premiere that Universal has created for us in New York, like party. You know, they rented this ship and all this stuff, and we're going to do it, but it all got canceled because of the strike.
Yeah, none of the actors could come out in support of it.
No. So then it wasn't kind of a point to have the premiere party there.
What was your favorite part of the process? I know every movie is different to make, but in this one in particular, which was so complex and so hairy, what was your favorite part of the process? Was it pre-production, designing the creature, designing the sets, being on the shoot and actually carrying through all these complicated elements and making them work together in concert? Was it post-production with music and sound effects or building the CG? What's your favorite part of the process?
I mean, it's always shooting, even though no matter how grueling a production day is, it's always watching the actors just nail a moment that you know, whether it's Woody doing a very complicated scene about Toby's character, his character Toby, or it's Clemens, Corey, or it's Aisling, or the group in group scenes, that we just find the right tone and it's the right interplay and the right energy between the characters and the actors. That's and also seeing the visual, seeing we finding angles that are portraying these moments in the way I like, is also setting up the camera and seeing that, okay, we're covering this there, and we're doing this, we're getting a big, beautiful close-up in that moment. If we shift the camera over to him, all this stuff. I love playing with the camera.
Yeah.
And blocking. I love blocking scenes. I think that's so much fun.
Yeah, you say that you shot-listed the whole movie for Long Walk beforehand, but it sounds like you're not married to those shot lists. You find yourself when you're discovering the drama of what the camera sees when you're on the set.
Yeah, I think there is, I mean, there is this, I guess, this old idea that you need to come in prepared, but you should pay attention when you're there.
Yeah.
And see what's in front of you in a way, and relate to that and react to that. And I will always do that. But I also love working with the actors, figuring out the scene in prep, like talking through it and finding the right psychology for why am I doing this? How am I reacting to this? Seeing the actors engaged and get into the moment and rehearsing with each other and figuring out, and then seeing how that can play visually. And then, I will ask that, okay, during rehearsals in prep, okay, so if you walk over there, would that feel natural? You know, if you walk there, should you be close to the other actor at this moment? Should you approach the other actor in this moment? What feels natural and what looks good? And where's the balance between those things? I love that process. Yeah.
What will you be doing opening night?
I think I'm going to LA actually, so I'm going to be hanging with the actors who are there, and right. With Brad and Mike
be jumping from theater to theater and watching audience reactions.
I mean, we might actually go to a movie theater and see it. That might be, we're talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. See that's it. Such yeah. A thrilling experience to see it with an audience for the first time.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, André, I wish you all the best of luck with this. It's so great to catch up with you again and hope to be able to see you soon. And I look forward to visiting your homeland in October.
Yes. Well, welcome. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's a wonderful festival, really great people and a great place to be.
I can't wait. Well, good luck and thanks again. And I can't wait to see the audience response.
Thank you. Talk soon. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.